Lecture 3, Forms of Jewish Scripture.
In the previous lecture, I summarized what might be called the best scholarly guesses concerning the origins and shape of the compositions making up the Hebrew Bible, or Tanakh. At the stage in which I was describing them, of course, they were not yet a collection, but rather a set of compositions that had not yet reached a fully fixed state. In this presentation, I want to look at our first real historical glimpse of these scriptures and the role they played in actual Jewish life. The period is the time of the Mediterranean world, which was dominated by Greco-Roman culture, Greek culture, and Roman rule, roughly between the first century before the Common Era and the second century of the Common Era. You will remember this is precisely the period during which Christianity also arose. More on that later. Our knowledge of the Jewish scriptures in the first century of the Common Era is based mainly on literary evidence, literature produced by Jews, that is itself based upon and interpreting those scriptures. So there's a bit of circularity in this process. We read this literature, which is responding to those scriptures, in order to find out what those scriptures meant to the people who were writing about them. And what we learn from this literature is that Judaism in the first century of the Common Era is both distinctly unified and internally divided, and both aspects are of great importance. From the outside, from the perspective of Gentile observers, Judaism appears as remarkably unified, an extended family, indeed a second race among the world's nations. But when we look more closely at this literature, we see that Judaism takes many and even competing forms within itself. Now, the term Torah, which I described in the last presentation, can stand as a central symbol that unified Jews throughout the Mediterranean world. It's obvious that if we were to find a single term that described what all Jews had in common, the term Torah would quickly come to mind. Torah signified at least five things to Jews in that period. First of all, it pointed to a set of shared texts, which I described in the previous presentation, texts that were read in worship and that were studied. Above all, the text that we called Torah, the Law of Moses. Second, Torah connotes as well a shared story found within those texts, a story that provides all Jews with a sense of identity among the nations. So Torah is not simply instruction, it is also the story of a people extending back even before the patriarchs, through the patriarchs, Moses, Joshua, the judges, the kings, and so forth. All of this meant that Jews of the first century had a sense of shared identity because they shared the same story. Thirdly, Torah means also a set of fundamental convictions that all Jews shared. Three convictions in particular were important. The first was that God was one. This is the conviction that most distinguishes Jews religiously from everybody else in the ancient world. All other people in the ancient Mediterranean world were polytheists. That is, they regarded the divine as distributed through various personal forces in charge of various aspects of nature. For Jews alone, God was singular. God was one. There was only one ultimate power that was both the source and the goal of all that was created. The second conviction was a corollary of that one, namely that the one God has chosen one people as God's own, and this is the people Israel. This is the sense of election. not because they were particularly good or talented, but because God wanted a single people to be something of a living laboratory for what God could do with humans. The third conviction was that this one God and this one people were locked into a relationship that bore the name covenant, Brit. On one side, God pledged God's self to this people to be faithful and loving. On the other side, the people pledged to God to be faithful and to be obedient and loving, obedient to God and loving toward each other. One God, one people, one covenant. The fourth shared element that comes under Torah is that Torah contains all of the commandments, the mitzvot, that spell out the demands of covenant on the side of the people. And Jews all throughout the Mediterranean world were linked by this shared practice of the commandments. Above all, the observance of circumcision of male children, the observance of the Sabbath rest, and other moral and ritual obligations. The commandments, in other words, spelled out the demands of covenant. Finally, Torah also provided the basis for a wisdom or a philosophy of life based on the covenant and the commandments. Jews were convinced that God had not been arbitrary in commanding certain forms of practice and certain forms of obedience. Rather, Torah represented the right way to live in the world. Therefore, to be obedient to God's commandments was to be wise in living in the world. This aspect of Torah had two consequences. One, that for Jews of the first century, the study of Torah was almost as important as the practice of Torah. Torah was really to be read and meditated on day and night. The second corollary is that in the Greco-Roman culture, Jews were able to persuasively argue that they represented the oldest and best of philosophies. That is, that just as the Greeks sought wisdom, so the Jews had this ancient Eastern wisdom in Torah that provided the best of all guides to life. And in the period of the first century, Judaism was far from being a dying religion. It was, in fact, an aggressively proselytizing religion, and many Gentiles were deeply attracted to Judaism and converted to Judaism precisely because its practices, the form of its worship, and Torah itself seemed to be indeed a deeper, older, and finer philosophy of life than that offered even by the greatest of the Greeks. On the other side of the coin, Jews in the Mediterranean world of the first century of the Common Era were also diverse and sometimes divided. Let me mention four aspects of this diversity. First, geography. More Jews lived in the diaspora than in Palestine or Eretz Israel. The term Eretz Israel or Palestine is obvious. The term diaspora refers to the scattering of the people to any other place other than Palestine. What is remarkable is that as many as 5 million Jews lived in the diaspora in the first century, compared to perhaps 2 million Jews within Palestine. So by far, the greater number of Jews lived outside of Palestine in the first century than lived in Palestine. Again, the contemporary comparison is obvious. Secondly, Jews were divided linguistically. In the diaspora to the west, in the Roman Empire, Jews spoke predominantly Greek and had done so for hundreds of years. The diaspora to the west, in Babylon, Jews spoke Hebrew and Aramaic. In Palestine, all three languages were spoken. Hebrew was read in the synagogue, Aramaic was spoken among the common people, but Greek is also well attested within Palestine. But it makes a difference what language one speaks, and in terms of how one understands reality. The third point is that culturally, Jews in the diaspora were a tiny minority among pagan neighbors, yet remarkably enjoyed genuine privileges within Greek and Roman culture. They were free to practice their religion without restraint. In Palestine, Jews were a majority, and yet they were an oppressed majority because of the presence of Roman rule. The fourth and most important point of division, however, was ideology. Jews disagreed among themselves on how best to respond to the aggressive cultural challenge posed by Greco-Roman culture and Roman rule. Remember that the Hellenistic culture that had begun with the death of Alexander the Great in 323 before the Common Era was an aggressive, hegemonic cultural program in which the vision was for a unified humanity, in which the universal was to be preferred to the particular. People should not marry within their tribe. They should marry anybody in the world. They should not speak their own languages. They should all speak Greek. They should not have simply one God, but should embrace the whole pantheon of gods. This powerful cultural force, which was found both within Palestine and in the diaspora, obviously raised questions for a people who thought of itself as a family that married only other Jews, that had only one God, and so forth. So, in effect, after the exile, the Judaism became an immovable object within Palestine that had to deal with an irresistible force, which was Hellenistic culture. This was complicated by the fact that from the year 63, before the Common Era, Rome's patron-client relationship with Jews, which had begun in the Maccabean Revolt, when Rome says, oh, you want to fight against Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes? Let us help you out. And the Jews signed a treaty with Rome. This reached its climax in the year 63 when Pompey entered Jerusalem. And from that point on, Jews within Palestine lived under the shadow of Roman government. Within Palestine, then, much more than in the diaspora, Jews divided among themselves on the basis of how best to respond to these factors, Greek culture, Roman rule. Remember, in antiquity, religion is not something separate from politics. Politics and religion go together. All religion is political in its implications. So the various groups or sects within Judaism in the first century in Palestine were defined as much by their religious perspectives as by their political perspectives. Sadducees was a group of people who were fundamentally grouped around the aristocracy, the upper classes, and focused upon the worship in the temple in Jerusalem. The Pharisees were a moderate group that formed intentional fellowships committed to the keeping perfectly of all the laws of Torah, whether one was in the temple or not. Thus, all Pharisees kept all the laws of purity required by Torah. The Essenes were a very strict group that tried to separate themselves not only from Greeks and Romans, but also from other Jews who didn't observe the laws as strictly. And the Essenes took this to a logical extreme in the form of the monks at Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls originated. They separated themselves totally from the rest of society and lived their life of holiness, of separation, at Wadi Qumran in the Judean desert. And finally, the Zealots, who were committed to a military revolt against Roman rule and to the use of violence in order to restore the traditional kingship to Israel. very strong internal divisions in which there was not only enmity between Jews and outsiders, but between among Jews themselves. Now, this combination of factors generated a huge amount of literature, which is still extant, in both Hebrew and Greek, that forms the basis, together with archaeological information, for example, the digging up of the community at Qumran in 1947, that forms the basis of our knowledge. Now, when we look at all of this literature, what we find is that Torah is, as I've suggested, a symbol of unity in first century Judaism. But it is also a source of contention among these competing groups. And the contention took the form of three major factors. First, Jews did not firmly agree on what actually constituted the Bible or Torah, which writings were to be regarded as scripture. Take, for example, the Samaritans and the Sadducees, each of whom recognized only the five books of Moses as their Bible. The Samaritans lived in the former northern kingdom of Israel and had their own temple located at Shechem. They were regarded by the Judeans, the Jews, as not fully Jewish, sort of half Jew, half Gentile, because they, in the eyes of Jews, they had mixed with native population and had not stayed pure. The Samaritans themselves, however, considered themselves to be the most faithful of all Jews. They called themselves Hashomrim, the conservatives. And they read the five books of Moses as their Bible in Hebrew, and in fact, the Samaritan Pentateuch is one of the oldest forms of the books of Moses that we have. Indeed, the Samaritans even looked forward to a Messiah that would be a prophet like Moses, based upon the saying found in Deuteronomy 18:15 that God would raise up a prophet from among the people like Moses. So the Samaritans had only five books. So did the Sadducees. The Sadducees, as I've suggested, were an aristocratic, upper-class, high-priestly group that defined itself very much in terms of the worship of the temple and were, again, deeply conservative, both in their political and religious views. Politically, go along with the dominant culture. Religiously, stick to the five books of Moses and nothing more. And this accounts for the fact that the Sadducees also had the most conservative theological views of Jews in that age. They did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. They did not believe in a Messiah, but basically because these were not to be found in the five books of Moses. They did not believe in angels because angels weren't found in the five books of Moses. If we go to the diaspora, and we see the writer Philo of Alexandria, who was an astonishingly prolific writer, an older contemporary of St. Paul, the Christian missionary. Philo also seemed to focus almost exclusively on the law of Moses in his extensive writings, although he is clearly aware of the prophets and the other writings. In contrast, at Qumran, the Essene sect recognized and made commentary on both the books of Moses and the prophets, but they also collected and wrote a number of apocryphal writings of their own. The Pharisees were the group that seemed to have had the most inclusive sense of Scripture in the first century. They included the books of Moses, the prophets, and the writings, and in fact, they also had their own distinctive understanding of oral Torah. That is, they understood as part of Torah the history of its interpretation through oral transmission. The Pharisees were deeply committed to law being flexible and applicable to everyday life. In sum, when we look at these different groups, we see that they did not agree about what was in the Bible. Diversity can also be seen in the version of Scripture used by Jews in the first century. In the Western diaspora, the Hebrew text had been translated into Greek already by the year 250 before the Common Era. A legend recounted in the composition called The Letter of Aristeas, which is also attested to by Philo and Josephus, among other Jewish writers, recounts how Ptolemy II of Egypt, a Hellenistic ruler living in Alexandria, saw that the Jews of Alexandria needed their Bible translated into Greek, and so invited Jewish scholars from Palestine to come to Alexandria. And this translation is called the Septuagint because the word Septuagint means the 70. And the legend is that 70 of these Jewish scholars came and translated all of the Bible into Greek. This was so highly regarded in the Western diaspora that the Septuagint was regarded as inspired by God and was read as sacred scripture. And Jews in the diaspora in the West exclusively used the Septuagint, perhaps little aware of the differences between the Greek and the Hebrew. Now, there are three lessons to be learned from this translation, which, if we think about it, was already in existence and had been used for a period of time as long as the history of the United States, as we are thinking about it today. For hundreds of years, Jews in Alexandria had been reading their Bible in Greek and not in Hebrew. What this means, of course, is that Hebrew and Greek had coexisted already in Palestine for some time. Otherwise, those Jewish scholars from Palestine could not have been able to translate from Hebrew into Greek. It also indicates how badly a Greek translation was needed, since Jews in the diaspora could no longer read their Bible in Hebrew. The third lesson is that the Septuagint, unknown to those who could not compare it to the Hebrew, really says very different things in many cases than the Hebrew text. In some places, the Greek translation is very literal, almost woodenly literal, so literal that it's almost unintelligible as Greek. But in other places, the Greek text goes its own way and is much more fanciful and imaginative in its translation. So there were huge consequences to Jews in the diaspora. Remember, the majority of Jews having Greek as their Bible rather than the Hebrew. But even in Palestine, Hebrew seems to have been exclusively used in the synagogue worship and in study among scholars. But we are aware of the appearance of Aramaic translations already in the first century. In fact, these Aramaic translations, called Targums, may go all the way back to the 5th century. The book of Nehemiah, chapter 8, verse 13, recounts a solemn scene in which the law of Moses is read to all the assembled people. After it is read, Ezra the scribe, remember a scribe is a book person, somebody who can write and read, translated or interpreted this law to all the people, and they rejoiced. So already in the 5th century, there was the need to take the ancient texts and contemporize them in a more recent dialect of Hebrew called Aramaic. These targums were not written until perhaps the 7th century of the Common Era, but they are based upon a very long oral tradition. And they suggest that Hebrew was not familiar to many worshiping Jews, even in Israel. The third factor is that Jews in the first century also interpreted their scripture from distinctive perspectives. Our knowledge on this point, to be sure, is selective and based on the extant literature. The zealots, those militant opponents to Roman rule, may well have had their own interpretation of Scripture, but we don't have it, because the zealots tended to be activists rather than contemplatives and writers. But when we look at the literature we do have, we see that Philo of Alexandria, reading the Greek translation, possibly not even knowing Hebrew, interpreted the Bible in the same way that Stoic philosophers interpreted the Greek classics of Homer and the tragedies. Namely, they sought moral instruction from these sources. And when the classical texts seemed to be saying impossible or scandalous things, used the method of allegorical interpretation in order to yield a deeper wisdom and a proper morality. Pharisees in Palestine used the method called midrash, from the Hebrew darash, to seek, as a way of bringing up to date ancient written commandments and being able to apply them to new circumstances in accord with their commitment to a priestly life of purity. For example, and this is why the relationship between Pharisees, who were committed to interpretation, and the scribes, who had the technical capacity to carry out interpretation, was so important. So in the New Testament, we always see scribes and Pharisees together. Take an ancient commandment such as leaving the corner of a field unharvested so that orphans and widows and sojourners might be able to sustain themselves in life. It was by means of midrash that the Pharisees were able to bring that ancient written commandment and make it applicable to new circumstances, namely life in a large urban environment, and used that ancient legislation concerning the peya, the corner, to develop organized welfare systems within the Jewish community. Finally, the Qumran sect, the Essenes, who lived out in the Judean desert, who regarded nobody else as Jews except themselves. They did not regard the Pharisees or the Sadducees or the Samaritans as real Jews, but only themselves. They interpreted the Hebrew text from the perspective of their sectarian identity as the community of the pure, formed and instructed by their founder, the teacher of righteousness. And they used their pesher interpretation, the word pesher simply means interpretation, to apply all of Scripture to the life of their community. So they would, in a commentary on the Psalms, would write a verse of the psalm and then say, Pesher, interpreted, this means, and they would apply it directly to the history of the experience of their community. In fact, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran in 1947 and subsequent archaeological and literary study is of the first importance for the knowledge of the Hebrew Bible in the first century. In that great library at Qumran, we discover the oldest extant manuscripts we have of the Hebrew Bible. Some 225 biblical manuscripts, most of them in tiny fragments, although we have the entire scroll of the book of Isaiah. And the numbers of copies of these biblical books indicates the importance they held for the community. And we see at Qumran that they thought of Moses and the prophet and the Psalms. They quoted the Psalms more often, and then Deuteronomy, and then Isaiah. Fascinatingly, these three categories, Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms, are also categories used in the New Testament. And the Psalms and Deuteronomy and Isaiah are also the books of the New Testament that are quoted most often in the New Testament. When we look at those biblical manuscripts, furthermore, we see that they have many more variations within them than the later standard versions of the Hebrew Bible that we will discuss later. Now, this sect's practice of collecting and writing biblical apocrypha suggests simultaneously the central position of Torah and their notion that it was malleable. It could be expanded. It could be commented on. They rewrote Genesis in the Genesis Apocryphon. The same combination is found in Qumran's sectarian mode of interpretation. Torah is all important, but it is constantly read in light of contemporary experience. The findings at Qumran are of supreme importance on two counts. First, they tell us about the variety of first century Judaism within Palestine and its use of the Bible that was simply not available to us before the year 1947. And second, they point us to another sectarian Jewish community that used Scripture in a remarkably similar fashion, which we will consider next time when we talk about the birth of the Christian Bible.